Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Greetings, happy Wednesday, happy hump day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Voice of Indie podcast. This is episode number 107. I am your host, Mr. Beam Weeks, and with me is Mr. Stephen G. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm doing great. I thought we were on episode 22. I must have fallen asleep at some point here. 107. Yeah. Wow, this is crazy stuff. Yeah,
we're
the frogs and I are doing Frogs and I are doing great. I got the same three big old frogs out there that people keep seeing on social media every now and then. But I got a new one this week, the size of your thumbnail. Brand new, just came out of a polywog state, and he's out there hanging with the big fellows, eating little bugs while they eat the big bugs. So we're having a good time. Last night I had my meeting with our marketing guy, Sam Wilson. A lot of you know him, Sam at freshinkgroup.com. And every Tuesday we go over analytics and work on finishing up the newsletter and stuff like that. And as we were going through the analytics, he was showing that our numbers on the newsletter are rising literally every week. We're getting a lot of opens. We're getting a lot of click-throughs. Obviously, you know, we'd like them to keep going up. But we're finding that people are clicking through. They're watching the trailers from the newsletter. They're clicking through to Amazon or Barnes & Noble to make purchases. They're going over to the author pages. They're coming in and signing up for the newsletter. So pretty much all the different things that we've been doing in the newsletter are getting people's clicks. Even the ones down at the bottom of the newsletter where we tout our various websites, some of those are getting clicks. People are going and visiting those websites. So we're cool about that. Now, one of the things that he's going to be working on this week, we're going to ask for help out there from you people, is next week's guest is retired Naval Lieutenant Commander Jerry Pate, who has a book called Submariner. And this guy was the man of the nuclear sub fleet, and he's got the stories to tell. And with him is going to be co-guest Robert G. Willis Croft, who helped him compile the book, put all this stuff together. And many of you know Willis Croft is the author of science fiction series, several other kinds of books, plus the Mac McDowell Mission series, an ex-Navy man himself. So he knows about this stuff. So what we're asking this week is we're looking for reaching out to finding Navy audiences, people who'd be interested in this book, interested in listening to the podcast next week with these gentlemen, Facebook groups, websites, any of that kind of stuff. If you know of any of these kinds of things, let us know, or let Sam at freshinkgroup.com know, because we're going to do some hardcore reaching out this week, see if we can find some people who like to read books about submarines.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that should be fun to get that episode together with those two naval guys. Over on Twitter, we've already got a couple of comments. This is kind of getting to be a Wednesday thing. Verwayne Greenho, with his Vela project, he says, "I'm starting a Vela project based on the 1948 flash fiction story Knock by Frederick Brown. The last man on Earth sat alone in a room. There was a knock on the door. My goal will be to write stories that use the last line as an important line in my story. So keep an eye out for that. We'll give you updates as Verwayne brings them to us."
Yeah, definitely. Keep them coming, Verwayne. And over on Twitter, Robert Willis Croft says, "Looking forward to listening to someone more prolific than I am. Smiley face." Yeah, we do have a prolific author today. A lot of people don't know it, but decades ago, he used to own and operate his own publishing company. So he's got a lot more writing out there that's waiting to be republished or updated or things like that. And he also owns the rights to a lot of other stuff that we're talking about as well, too. So this guy knows the business. He knows his books. He knows his topics. And he's an interesting guy to talk to. We're looking forward to having him on today.
And Joe Congel also says, "Hey, everyone, looking forward to tonight's guest. Welcome aboard, Joe." Speaking of Robert G. Willis Croft, the first volume of his Daedalus series, called Daedalus, is currently free. It's a giveaway. And he's doing pretty good numbers.
In Kindle.
In Kindle, yeah, in Kindle.
Yeah.
You know, usually that's what it is, but
usually, but
he's doing pretty good numbers over there. He's his best on the bestsellers ranking. He's 7,186. So that's free in the Kindle store. For 90-minute science fiction and fantasy short reads, he's number 20. And hard science fiction in the Kindle store, he is number 25. And in 90-minute literature and fiction short reads, he's number 82.
And
his reviews are pretty good.
Yeah, that's not just limited to science fiction. That's 90-minute literature, period,
literature,
all genres.
Yeah.
82, so those are fantastic numbers.
He's doing some big numbers. And customer reviews, he's averaging 4 out of 5 stars after 19 reviews on that. So congratulations, Robert G. Willis-Croft.
Yeah, cool. And we appreciate you keeping us informed of this stuff. We like these kinds of things to put in the newsletter and talk about on the podcast. We need all of our authors to be proactive. Get out there and brag when you're getting stuff done. I got another request for our guests out there today. We're working on this food truck book series for A.K. Wingler. And the How to Start and Run Your Own Food Truck Business in Florida is already out. How to Start and Run Your Own Food Truck Business in Georgia is coming out this week. And How to Start and Run Your Own Food Truck Business in Tennessee is going to follow about 3 to 4 weeks after that. And we're just going to be knocking these states down like dominoes. One of the cool things that we're doing with this is collecting photos of food trucks. Now, everybody out there, wherever you are, has seen food trucks somewhere. You know, they're parked in the parking lot of the local shopping center. They might be at the county fair, wherever. So we're going to ask you, when you see a cool-looking food truck, take a picture of it for us. And if you're really into it, take a picture of the menu, maybe take a picture of some of the food they serve, take a picture of their logo as it's painted on the truck, because as we put these books out, we're filling them with pictures of food trucks all around the U.S. and around the world to give people ideas and encouragement and show them what a variety and how limitless the ideas are for doing this kind of stuff. Plus, there's another way that we're using those, and what is that, Beam?
We're using that in the yourfoodtruckhowto.com site. It's an interactive site. You can go over there and click on things and check out different things and have a good time with it. So get over there, yourfoodtruckhowto.com, yourfoodtruckhowto.com. And, you know, share it on Twitter. Let us know what you think of the site and have fun with it. It's really cool.
Yeah, and you can share your pictures of food trucks right through that website as well.
Yes, you can. That's the interactive part. You can, you know, leave comments, you can share pictures, and just have fun with it.
You can also ask questions of the food truck experts too, Andrea and her partner and the people they work with.
Yeah, because that's the big up-and-coming booming thing. I shouldn't even say up-and-coming. It's here, food trucks, and we got them all over the place here. So, I mean, it's the wave of the future. Listeners, if you want to participate in tonight's show, which we really want you, give us a call, get on Twitter. Here's how you can do all that stuff.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest, or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
Cool. Hopefully we'll get some calls tonight. Get that tweet machine going. Hashtag Fresh Ink Group.
Yeah.
All right, got another announcement to make. It's becoming the year of Ingram. Many of you who are regular listeners, both of you, probably remember earlier this year I predicted that there was going to be a lot of upheaval by the end of this year, and we've been watching it happening slowly but surely. As of this week now, Ingram has announced that in the United Kingdom and the European Union, print costs are going up 4.9% at the end of this month. That's a big jump. But they did not go up the last time they went up in the U.S. So basically, just they're catching up with us on that side of the pond. Now, the other thing, those of you who are into publishing, I have no idea what's going on with Ingram Spark. Usually people who use Ingram Spark keep me informed, and I haven't heard anything lately. But the relationship between Fresh Ink Group and Ingram goes back 27 years. And 24 years ago is when we went global. And at the time, we had contracts with printers, print-on-demand companies in countries all around the world. It took me a long time and a lot of work to get all that set up. And, you know, that's when we went international. That's when we started promoting our books are available worldwide. Now, we all know there's places in Indonesia that, you know, it's hard to order books and a couple of African countries and stuff, but pretty much worldwide you can find our books. In the case of this, we wound up consolidating over the years a lot of our contracts with Ingram because, like, I had a company in Brazil, for example, that would print all of our stuff for South American market. Ingram bought them. It's like, okay, well, I don't need a contract with them anymore. We folded it into our Ingram contracts. There are many of those, the companies that I used to use, that Ingram now owns. There's still some that Ingram doesn't own. Like, for example, we have three authors in the London area, and when I need to print author copies for them, I use a different company than Ingram because I can get a slightly better deal over there. And so far, Ingram has not bought that company, but sometimes it feels like Ingram's looking over my shoulder. Oh, who else are you dealing with there? Quick, buy them. You know, but the whole point of this is we're down now to where about 85-90% of our printing worldwide and virtually all of our distribution is through Ingram. And we just got informed this week that all of our contracts with Ingram are expiring at the end of this month. And we are invited to apply for new contracts. How that's going to play out, I don't know. But I'm feeling my feathers a bit ruffled, frankly, after a quarter century relationship, feeling a little bit treated like, hey, get in line, fella. You know, but I have been to the house of the vice president of content acquisition in Nashville. I know where he lives. And, you know, I may need to show up there and say, we need to talk. But we'll see how this plays out. We'll keep you listeners informed. But there is a lot of upheaval in the print on demand and indie publishing industry happening right now. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays.
All right. So, yeah, that's the business side of it. But here's the fun side. Water Lilies Over My Grave by Patricia A. Guthrie is available now. Get over to Amazon and
grab
your copy.
Is that book any good?
That's an excellent book. That is an excellent book. Patricia is a stellar writer. I'm telling you, she's everything I've read of hers is just she's a magnificent writer. She knows how to tell a good story, and she creates characters that are they just pull you right in.
Yeah.
Also out this week is Minority Millennials in the Workplace by Janelle Gordon. And Stephen,
that's got something coming up on that one. That is Workforce. I don't know why you keep reading Workplace, but it's Minority Millennials in the Workforce.
Yeah.
You did that last week, too.
I'm used to saying Workplace.
I know, so am I.
Minority Millennials in the Workforce by Janelle A. Jordan. And Stephen, after we run, we've got something to talk about for that book. So
you want to
keep up to date on all these books that are coming out through Fresh Ink Group. You want to know who the guests are going to be on the Voice of Indie podcast. You want to know a little bit something about these guests before the show starts. Here's how you can find out. We've got a newsletter.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Ink Group with our weekly digital newsletter, new releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
You know, with that title, Minority Millennials in the Workforce, I tend to just kind of glance down to see what's coming up and then...
Well, I kept typing workplace when I first started working on the book, and there were like at least three or four times I had to go check, which one is it? What is that title again? So it's kind of embedded in my mind now, but I get what you mean. It comes off the tongue too easy. But anyway, speaking of Minority Millennials in the Workforce by Janelle A. Jordan, she's on our bestseller list again this week. So let's see how this list is playing out for our print bestsellers. This is print books now, soft covers and hard covers. But so far this week, our bottom two slots, numbers 4 and 5, are held by the hardcover and soft cover of Mark Herndon's The High Road, Memories from a Long Trip. Mark Herndon, as you know, played drums for the supergroup Alabama for almost 3 decades, and now he's playing drums with his wife, country singer Leah Seawright. And he wrote a kind of a tell-all, but he took the high road. You know, he wasn't dishing dirt and trying to make people look bad. He just told the story.
Didn't bash anybody.
didn't bash anybody. He just told the story the way it happened, made him, when he looked bad, he made himself look bad too. And it's just a good heartfelt memoir of what it was like growing up, having the dream and then getting to live that dream. And then seeing that dream kind of snatched away from you in a lot of ways. This book, we published it 6.5 years ago, and I treat sales and numbers and all that kind of stuff of all of our authors is highly confidential. I never talk about what one author's doing with another, you know, other than to say, you know, that this one's our number one this week or something that we can brag about. Mark Herndon's book, 6.5 years ago, we published that. I'm still sending him royalties over $1,000 a month after 6.5 years, sometimes $2,000 and $3,000 a month. I don't think he'd mind me telling you that. That book is always one of our perennial bestsellers. Right now it's in the fourth and fifth slot, but if you go above it to the number three slot, outselling that book is When Angels Fly by Mary Schmidt. And I believe that one's billed as by S. Jackson. Does that sound right, Beam?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's S. Jackson is the main one on there, but if you look for it under Mary Schmidt, it pops up anyway. But When Angels Fly is the memoir talking about her basically dealing with the medical establishment when her young son got pediatric brain cancer, and he wound up losing that battle at age 5. It's a heartfelt book. It's sometimes very sad, sometimes reaffirming, but it's poignant and meaningful and really says a lot. So it's good to see that book doing well right now. It's in our number three slot. Now, if you take what's in our number three slot and multiply those sales by 10 times the number three slot, our number two slot is the softcover edition of Still Not Enough, Minority Millennials in the Workforce by Janelle A. Jordan. If you take her softcover sales and double that number, that's her hardcover sales for this week. Still Not Enough, Minority Millennials in the Workforce. She's outselling Herndon by like 60 to 1 right now. And she's easily in our number one and two slots. Congratulations, Janelle. That's 3-4 weeks in a row now she's been in the top slots.
Woo-hoo. All right. Now, also out this week for pre-sale is Submariner by retired Naval Lieutenant Commander Jerry Pate with Robert G. Willis Croft. And Practical Problems by tonight's guest, J.H. Looney. So keep an eye out for those. Get over there for the pre-sale. And you're going to find out more about Practical Problems tonight when we bring Mr. Ash Looney in. Now, if you missed an episode of this program or you just want to relive one of your favorite shows, and apparently a lot of people, that's their source for listening to these shows is in the archives, because we do bigger numbers in the archives than we actually do live, although the live is starting to catch up there. So we get more people in here and more audience interaction, and this can be a whole lot of fun. It's already fun, but if you want to know where to find these archived episodes, here's how you do that.
If you miss a show, find us in the archives in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, on Spotify, or under the podcast tab at freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. On YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe.
Yeah. All
like,
right.
Like.
Let's get to introduce our guest. J.H. Looney is author, journalist, editor, and playwright residing in Detroit. When he is not writing, he is reading or engaged in research on any number of topics that satisfy his need for stimulation or escape. When these all fail, he can be found in theaters, museums, and concert halls soaking up the art that is too often underappreciated. Hey, somebody has to do it. And with that, welcome to the show, J.H. Looney.
Thank you. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Do you want us to call you? I enjoyed listening to all your
introductory stuff.
Yeah, cool.
Very, very impressive. Very impressive. You sound
all
like you know what you're doing.
Well,
good for you.
We're just tricking you.
First step is faking it. Second step is learning how to do what you've been faking. But you want us to call you Jay at Jay the initial, or Joe, or Joseph, or what's your preference?
Joseph is fine.
Okay.
Joseph.
But remember, listeners, the author name that you're looking for out there is Jay Period Ash Looney. And he's got a ton of books, so get out there and find out what he's got, or keep listening, because we're going to talk about him.
All right. So, Joseph, you're in Detroit, correct?
I am. It's a beautiful – yes, sir, and it's a beautiful evening here.
Yeah, okay. I'm about
90
minutes from you.
Nice showers.
So,
Yeah.
You had showers today?
We had some nice afternoon showers. Wow. Not too heavy, but but a good for the flowers, good for the lawns. So yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
And we had a cool evening.
We didn't get any rain over here, so you know, cool. We had rain all through the weekend and whatnot, so the grass and the flowers are looking good.
Good.
So as a native from the Detroit area, did you go away to go to school, or did you go somewhere in Michigan?
No, I went to. I only ever applied for one university, and that's the main university in the city of Detroit called Wayne State University.
A fine university.
One of the big three in the state.
Yeah.
U of M and Michigan State University. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I graduated in a journalism program when they still had an exclusively journalism program. Subsequent to my graduation, it was merged into a communications and speech department, and it's still going strong.
Yeah, I noticed Michigan State did that. When they formed their communications department about 30 years ago, they folded their journalism department into it there as well. And it basically just became media reporting, you know, how to do TV news as well as regular journalism and stuff like that.
Sure. We live in an increasingly video-oriented society. And now they basically have to learn multimedia production, writing and production. And you guys are a good example of that.
Yeah, we started out with straight just publishing, but you can't do that anymore. You've got to have all the different media. It's all got to be a package. And, you know, if you put out a book, you don't put out a book trailer, look what an opportunity you're missing. But
exactly.
If you got to go pay somebody to make that trailer for you, well, then you're just not going to make any money because that's an expensive thing usually.
Yeah.
Right.
So you guys have done good work for me. What do you do for your day job, Joseph?
Well, I run a couple of websites, and the principal one is geared towards documenting and providing research for university special collections and archives, rare book rooms, that kind of thing. And there are a lot of them around the country. Some interesting news came up today from the University of Michigan Library. A Galileo document was admitted to be a forgery. So that was quite interesting. Big news in the world of rare books today. And the way in which it was unmasked was very interesting as well. It's a detective story. And there's an article in today's New York Times about it. So I'm interested I always have been interested in libraries and as part of my application as a bibliophile. And I particularly enjoy, collector's books. Rare books, manuscripts, prints, maps, and that kind of thing. So that led me to work within these special collections at mostly university libraries, but most major libraries have special collections as well. It's
cool.
A fascinating subject. Yeah. So that's principally what I do, and I dabble around in a couple of other things.
Over on Twitter, Verwayne came back.
I'm too busy to have a job, let's put it that way.
I know that feeling. Verwayne says, I just saw a new one, meaning a food truck, in my little town on Monday. And he lives in a little town, too. Let me see if I can get you a photo. Thanks, Verwayne. We've got the soldiers out there marching now. And Marlena Smith-Burris says, hi, Fresh Ink Group fam. All right. Welcome to the family, Marlene. It's always good
to
have you.
Marlena.
Yep. And you got Joe?
Yeah, Joe Congel says, hi, Jay. I'm not really well-versed on playwriting. Do you find it more or less difficult than writing a novel? Oh, good question there.
Well,
to start us off.
Have you written a novel?
I've never written a novel. I've written lots of short stories. I'm not interested in writing a novel. Don't have the discipline or the desire. Anything
you don't have any kind
tell,
of like a
quickly.
You don't have like a manuscript you've been sitting on?
Nope.
All right.
Nope. But I do like short stories. I've always enjoyed short stories. It's probably my attention span, but I think that you can tell a good story quickly.
I agree.
A good novel, tells a lot of stories, and a long story, which is fine. Which is fine if you want to be engrossed by that. That's okay. I read novels, you know, mostly classic literature. But I write for the theater because I enjoy theater, and I've always been a theater nerd. Ever since elementary school, really, and through school, I was involved in the theater department. On stage, but mostly behind the stage, as crew, that kind of thing. I'm interested in stagecraft. So I've built lots of sets and torn down lots of sets, put it that way. And I enjoy costuming and set design. And a special application of mine is prop making. That's a kind of a hobby of mine. So, I mean, I've made lots of props for different shows, and that's quite fun. So that's why I write for the theater, to answer the gentleman's question. It's because that's my interest.
Yeah, for me, probably the biggest difference is if I'm going to write a novel, I'm going to spend months outlining and working on the details. If I write a short story, I might not outline that. You know, that's enough to keep track of in your head, and I might just jump in there and go see to the pants. But, you know, for a novel, you're going to have to spend a year working on it in most cases. Or in the case of Jazz Baby, what is it, 10 years, Dean?
8 years.
8 years? Yeah.
Well, six, technically six, because I put it up for 2 years, but it was an eight-year period. So.
Yeah. All right, well, we need to roll a couple of, at least the first commercial here about our friends over in the Carters with their Meet the Author podcast. And then, Joe, I want to know, you know, how vibrant is the play scene in the Detroit area? What's going on? All right, let's roll it, Beam.
All right.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Joan. We would like you to join us on Meet the Author podcast live every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S.
Yeah, Meet the Author podcast is a live video broadcast produced in association with WLFE-TV Radio, airing on Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Shortly after each episode ends, it's released on a dozen major podcast platforms.
We have casual conversations with authors of many genres. You will often hear humorous stories from their lives or sometimes some very poignant stories. Some of these people have overcome great obstacles to become authors. However, it's always a fun time.
It always is. So come join the fun, make comments, ask questions. We hope to see you at Meet the Author podcast live every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Find all the program links at indiebooksource.com. Until then.
That's all, folks.
All right. Yeah, I dropped in on them while prepping for this show and caught a little bit of tonight's episode. They've always got interesting guests on there, and it's always a fun time listening to other authors.
Give it our highest endorsement.
Yeah, wonderful people as well. Just really
sounds great.
So Joe, I many years ago, like 30 years ago, I was teaching a writing class, and one of the very young men in it, that was a young black man out of Detroit. And he went on to start his own publishing company with an erotica series and a romance series and whatnot. But he also writes plays as well, and he stages them right in Detroit, rents theaters for a couple of days, couple of nights or whatever, and rehearses them wherever he can, and then puts these shows on, does his own promotion or whatever, and either makes money or loses money. And so far, he's been making money and having a good time of it. I wouldn't have thought maybe there was that big of a market for something like that. But what are you seeing, Joe? What's going on out there in Detroit or your Southeast Michigan?
It's tough when you're an independent producer, and because you also have to be a promoter as well.
Uh-huh.
And the best production house, I would say Black Box Theater, in the downtown area is now closed. It closed maybe 5 years ago because the building was redeveloped. But that was a big blow, because that was the best house in town. And the owner of the facility, an individual who really encouraged theater. But there are several, you know, professional theater groups here. There's lots of community theater, which I was involved in for many years. And a lot of people overlook the high school market as well. Then there's, of course, the university theaters, which are pretty vibrant. My own theater, my own alma mater, Wayne State University, has a nationally renowned master's program in theater. which is they have a repertory theater company, which is one of the very few in the country, called the Hillbury. And they're presently redeveloping a whole new arts complex called the Gretchen Vallad Jazz Center, I believe. Gretchen Vallad, of course, is the heir to the Carhartt's fortune.
Mm-hmm.
She's been very, very generous in Detroit in funding jazz. She has a jazz label, and she single-handedly, I think, finances the or grants the money for the Detroit Jazz Festival to keep it free every year. So they're building a new jazz center, and the Hillbury Theater and the Undergraduate Theater, the Bon South, will be incorporated within that new building. So that's interesting. And then there's a very important theater called the Repertory Theater, which is specializes in mixed race casts, and it's in a very, very rugged neighborhood, but they've been able to survive. This will be their 66th season, and they're going strong.
Wow.
And a couple of others. I'm trying to think of the name of it, but another professional theater company is in the process of redeveloping a building, and they hope to have it ready by October to present three plays in the season. So that's good. I'm sure I can't think of their name right now.
They're still doing. They got that repertory out at Meadowbrook. They still doing stuff out there.
Yes. That's a program of Oakland University.
Yeah.
Meadowbrook Theater. It's a professional theater company. It operates independent of the university, but it's a great facility, a wonderful theater.
Wonderful.
And, they're still going strong. They do probably four plays a year, maybe.
Yeah, it was thriving last time I checked them out. But since I live in Alabama, I'm not plugged in like I used to be up there anymore. But we've also been seeing
every year they do. They're famous for their a Christmas Carol.
Yep, a Christmas Carol. Day. Yep,
they've been doing that for probably 40 years.
Yeah, and they decorate the Meadowbrook Mansion and the theater, outdoor theater, and all that stuff. It's a fun time. So what you're seeing then is it's growing. You see it as opportunities are out
stable.
There. Stable, at
I
least?
Think it's stable. Yeah, I think it's stable.
Okay.
There's a market for it. Yeah.
Now wait.
We've had
a guest on before named GM Lupo, and he's a playwright out of Atlanta. And he has the popular blog called Raised by Wolves, Lupo, Wolves, get it? And he writes these independent plays as well, and he's hooked up with a lot of the local community theaters around Atlanta, and he says they're begging for material. So, you know, that might be something for writers out there to explore if you've never written a play before. You know, make some contacts and, you know, see if you can stir up some interest.
A lot of community theaters have one-act festivals, and they solicit submissions, and normally from the local community. I've done several plays in that area, and I've also been a judge, and, you know, read plays that were submitted to a couple different theaters. I have a good friend who's a judge right now at the Barn Theater in Farmington Hills. But the problem is this, and as I see it from a I don't approach it necessarily, I mean, exclusively as a writer, a playwright. I approach it as a promoter and a producer. And the market for theater goers is still very small, very small. It's probably like dance. It's very tough. So you've got to try and build the market, develop the audience, but at the same time, be able to tap into the existing theater going community. And that's not always easy. So it's tough. That's why most theaters are nonprofits, because they can't make a profit. I mean, they always have to depend upon fundraising. So they have to be a nonprofit in order to be able to do that.
Well, one trend we've been noticing that seems like it would be good for theaters is the fact that concerts, which is the competition for, you know, spending the night at the theater, seeing a play, are being priced ungodly high now. Ungodly high. Bruce Springsteen tickets were going for $10,000. My lady friend wants to see the Eagles coming to Birmingham here. We were looking at tickets today, and they were $2,000 a piece. We wound up in the rafters in the back of the place for $500-something. I'll tell you, going to a play sounds like an attractive alternative, you know?
It is. Yeah. Those kinds of the prices are still probably, you know, very reasonable. No question about it. So yeah, it's a good value. There's another nice little theater here in Hamtramck, which is a city that's landlocked within the city of Detroit, called Planet Ant, and it started as an improv comedy colony, and they also do new work, in fact, almost exclusively new work, and they're they can do great stuff, and they have a cadre or a troupe, a company of players that they can rely upon to get things done. So they're they've got a very nice facility as well.
Yeah, so, we used to have a pretty vibrant theater community here in the capital city area in Lansing. We had the Alchemist Barn Theater, which ran for a long time, and that only recently shut down. And we had the Boar's Head Theater. Boar's Head Theater was kind of cool because that ran from 1966 until, I believe, 2009. And the guy that had formed it with some of his friends back in the 60s, his name was John Peaks. I went to school with his son. His son got killed while we were in school. He had a drinking problem, and he got hit on a moped and ended up losing his life. But
oh, my God.
They put together the Boar's Head Theater. And the cool thing is that one of the main cast members that was here for years was Timothy Busfield. He's a Lansing native. Then he went Hollywood and got on 30-something and started doing movies after that. And he's married to Melissa Gilbert, Half-Pint, from Little House on the Prairie. And they lived in the area for quite a while, but then he just took a position with, I believe it was one of the theaters in New York. So they sold one of their houses here. They still have his family home that he's had for years, but they're living in New York as of right now, but they still come home from New York once in a while to visit family.
That's a perfect segue into mentioning Jeff Daniels, the movie star Jeff Daniels, who's
right
from Chelsea, Michigan,
from
and founded the Purple Rose Theater.
Purple Rose.
Yeah, he did that after he starred in Woody Allen's movie called The Purple Rose of Cairo. Founded that theater, and it's a thriving theater company operating to this day. And every now and then, Jeff Daniels will make appearances in those places.
Yes, he does. He's right up the road. I mean, he still lives here. Now, in the 80s, he and his wife, who is his college sweetheart, they were married for many years, and they decided to make the jump to Hollywood. And they lived out there for a couple of years, and the way he put it, they turned Hollywood. They were going to all the parties and the crazy life, and they saw that their marriage was falling apart, so they moved back to Chelsea. And he lives on a farm there now, and that's where they raise their kids. And he said, you can have Hollywood. I'll work out there, but I'm staying here.
Yeah, so there ain't much Hollywood around Chelsea.
No, it's a small but lovely community.
Yeah.
He has had a phenomenal career. He really has. He's transcended it all.
He's also written quite
a number of plays. And a playwright, maybe a dozen different plays. And he also is a singer-songwriter. And he performs accompanying himself on acoustic guitar. And his son is a musician and has a band. So, I'm very impressed by Jeff. He's just wonderful for the community.
Yeah, he's supposed to be a hell of a nice guy, too. How dare he be all those great things?
Yeah.
I believe he's in a play in New York right now. He's always working.
He's doing Mockingbird. He's doing To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right now. Exactly.
Yeah.
We have a question from Joe Congel on Twitter. He says, Joseph, do you just write and produce your own plays, or do you have an agent or someone who is working on selling your plays to other producers? Not sure if that's how it actually works.
I no longer have an agent, but of course in the old days I tried to get one, and I did have one for a while, but not so much for my plays. It's difficult. Not that many agents will represent, especially one acts. It's very, very hard. That's why we developed this book, because it was a collection of one acts. So it gives, rather than being orphans now, they're enough part of a family, if you will.
Cool.
But the answer to that question is no. It's almost impossible to get an agent. And you really don't need one, because lots of theaters have open submission programs.
Cool.
You don't need an agent.
Robert G. Williscroft has a comment. He says, it would seem to me that if a writer can have a new play produced in a local theater and it goes over well, there should be an ongoing market there and otherwise locally for the author's future material. Have you found that to be part, you know, reality?
Well, that's everyone's hope. It's difficult. I myself am not that ambitious anymore because I've written a number of full-length plays as well, and I'm not interested in producing them myself. No, I don't want to do that. I'm not opposed to producing other people's plays, but I wouldn't want to produce my own. But hopefully, I have a full-length play that I'm very proud of that has yet to be produced. I'm not in any hurry for it. I think it'll happen when it happens. And the story is unique. I'm a bit of an expert in both the Beatles and in Motown. So I decided to put those two things together, and I wrote a story that fictionalizes the little-known relationship between Motown Records and the Beatles, because they did, in fact, have a relationship. A lot of Motown artists recorded Beatles songs, and, of course, the Beatles on their second U.S. album, which I think was called
Motown,
the Beatles' second album, there are three Motown songs on that album. So I thought to myself, how did that happen, especially so early? That was very early Motown. And so my story is called Motown Sound Mercy Beat. And, of course, Mercy is the river in Liverpool. And so the title encompasses both Motown and the Beatles. But it tells that story in a very credible way, how that relationship could have happened. So I'm very proud of that play. It's quite good. And I jam-packed it with every kind of reference from the 60s. So there's lots of context. You know, civil rights, rock and roll, peace movement, things that were going on in the world, Cold War. I mean, I threw it all in there. It's very rich. Probably I threw too much in, but I wanted to tell the story of the 60s. You know, it's an era where the counterculture, reigned supreme, and the peace, love, and all the different movements, and so I try to encompass that all in the story. So one day that'll be produced. It's called Motown Sound Mercy Beat.
Motown.
And did you know why the Beatles? I'll tell you the story. Do you know why the Beatles are called the Beatles? Why they spell it
B-E-A-T?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
of the cricket.
No, no.
Now,
no,
I've got a book here in my closet.
I know.
He chose the name the Beatles because they were Buddy Holly and the Cricket fans. So the
Beatles. Right. They were thinking insects. There was another band called the Bugs. But the reason why it's spelled B-E-A-T is because in Liverpool, before the phrase rock and roll became fashionable, it was called beat music. And that's why they were initially called, when they backed Tony Sheridan, they were called the Beat Brothers. So that's what they came up with, the Beatles. And, of course, there was a famous newspaper, a musical newspaper called the Mercy Beat. So, anyway, that's where it came from. But now people don't realize that the Mercy is the river that runs through Liverpool. And, of course, there's a famous song by Jerry and the Pacemakers called
Ferry
Across the Mercy.
Yeah,
cool.
Great song.
And for trivia fans, they were also, Jerry and the Pacemakers, were also represented by, managed by Brian Epstein.
Oh, okay.
They
all
were,
right,
part of his Liverpool.
Let's roll a couple of commercials about Joe's books, and then let's hear about them.
All right.
Like maybe the next two?
All righty.
Music has charms to soothe a savage breast. Nothing is certain but death and taxes. God helps those who help themselves. We've all heard these sayings, but have you ever wondered who said that? Hey, we've all looked for another way to say something, so wouldn't a resource for common ways of speaking come in handy? Or you could explore fun ways our language memes reach into the past. You could simply say, you win. But other ways to say it. Grab the brass ring. Beat the odds. Get the gold. Hit the jackpot. Beat the pants off of them and many more. It's all figuratively speaking. Who said that? Figuratively Speaking by Jay Aljuni, author, playwright, and word maven. Educational but interesting and fun. Explore the many ways we use language and then keep these books for reference. They're available now as jacketed hardcovers, plus soft covers and ebooks, iBook, Kindle, Nook, Google Play, and more. Who said that? And Figuratively Speaking are proudly published by Fresh Ink Group.
Every person has a private life and a secret self. This is true of those we know and people we only know because they are famous. Discover fascinating, intimate, clever, witty, poignant, insightful tales from a diverse roster of notable women who dare reveal both the unknown and the previously undisclosed. But these are not gossipy tales. No, they are personal, anecdotal, always meaningful stories for quiet reading, sharing aloud, even performing from the stage. Compiled by Detroit playwright Jay Aljuni, Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy, 65 fascinating excerpts from the memoirs of famous and infamous women is illustrated with whimsical portraits that capture these remarkable celebrities at their best. Choose your own from laminate hardcover, softback, and digital editions, all proudly published by Fresh Ink Group. Come away with a richer appreciation of these talented women and smile for permitting them to entertain you in unexpected and delightful ways.
Three excellent books. Those word books are especially cool.
I read word books a few years ago, and I concur. Those are excellent books. It's really interesting.
But now there's a Whoopi book. Go ahead.
No, the word books are fun to play with, and they're still very popular. I was reading a review of one the other day. I'm trying to think. It had a very clever title, and I cannot think of what it is. But it's published by Random House, so Jim McNeil, Robert Lehrer, the journalist, also is a word maven and wrote a number of books about books, books about words and phrases. That's fun.
Now the Whoopi book.
Let me say one thing. I have another book in my back pocket for you, and that is a book of foreign phrases that are popular in American English.
Yeah. And you know, this week's foreign word of the week is crudité. You know that, right? some people will know the reference, some won't.
What do you think about this title? It's going to be called The Avant-Garde Prima Donna.
Okay. And then, of course, a subtitle with a few keywords in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, I have that book done. I've done much with it.
I started to ask you about the Whoopi book because you had several purposes in mind when you were writing that, right?
Right. Well, I'll, for those listeners who are interested in the subject of theater and playwriting, I, many years ago, professionally was involved in a company that specialized in producing and presenting one-person shows for the simple reason that they're a lot easier. And the shows that I specialized in were all shows from England. And they all featured notable British stage actors who had written and, you know, developed their own one-person stage show. And I found that the best way to promote them was to university theater departments. And they came in as and presented a master class to theater students. They did patron dinners, worked with faculty, and then had public performances of their show. And this was a package, and it was designed really to raise awareness for the theater departments. And that convinced me that the most advantageous way to present theater is not to present it as a cost, but to present it as a revenue builder. Try and raise money using theater. It's just a fundraising idea. And I did that most successfully with Shakespeare festivals. There are probably about 250 Shakespeare festivals in North America. And they're mostly summer things. They're mostly outside. But they're all nonprofits. And they all constantly need to raise money. And so I represented a gentleman, and we put together a show called Meet William Shakespeare, which, you know, a one-person show starring an actor as Shakespeare, designed as an event that the Shakespeare Festival could sell to their patrons to spend an evening dining and drinking with William Shakespeare.
Hmm.
So that was my approach to getting plays done. The plays in this collection, Practical Problems, are not fundraising stories. But Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy, the previous book, is strictly a fundraising book. And that is designed mimicked the very popular Vagina Monologues presentation, which is this manuscript which is presented on the stage. It's not a play, but it's done on stage, but it's done live. And so I thought to myself, well, what would people want to hear? And so I came up with this idea of reading a whole lot of autobiographies of women and then selecting from them particular excerpts that I thought were interesting or fascinating or illuminating or poignant or funny or whimsical. And so that's designed. Those stories are designed to be read and to be heard orally, read orally and be heard verbally, I guess. And it's worked out pretty well. It's principally a good fundraising idea for women's organizations. And so that was the intent of that book.
Yeah, with so many famous women associated with it, famous names with that, it'd be an easier thing to market than a lot of obscure kinds of material as well.
Right, right. All my efforts to get the book to Whoopi Goldberg and invite me onto the her program, what is it called? The View? Were not successful.
Well, if you need her personal number, get with me after the show.
I presume she's still on it.
Yeah.
There's lots of drama. Regarding the talent on that show. I read that they just hired two talking heads. I'm not sure who they are. But anyway.
All right. Well, we're going to play the commercial for Practical Problems here in a second, Joe. We got a phone call we want to take first, then we'll play that commercial and then let you talk about Practical Problems.
Okay, fine.
All right. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show. You are on the air. Area code 646. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
It's me, Helen.
Hey, Dr.
Hello,
Helen.
Hello, Dr. Helen. Welcome to the show.
I am enjoying the talent of Fig's various writers.
Yeah.
And tonight was especially interesting and diverse.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that writer and his very varied mind.
Well, we appreciate the comment, definitely, and I'm sure he does too.
Yes, thank you.
Before we play the next commercial, you give us an update real quick. You feeling better, making some progress?
Nope. Still here. And
holding
it's
steady?
Slow. Not yeah. able to walk yet.
Well,
it's
we're,
tough,
we're,
but thank you. Thank you for your
you
good
best.
Words. And keep up the good work. I enjoy these seminars, these soirees every Wednesday.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you for calling in.
For listening,
I call
Dr. Helen,
Fig,
for calling in.
The Fig Seminar Soiree.
There you go.
Right.
Good luck to you.
Okay.
Good luck to you, Helen.
Thanks,
wish
guys.
You a recovery.
Keep up the good work.
Yep.
Thank you, Helen.
You have a stable of marvelous writers.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Helen.
Okay.
All right. Roller beam.
All right.
Discover Practical Problems: 10 Stories for the Stage by Jay Ashlooney. In Goin' Legit, mobsters seek a conventional bank loan with hilarious results.
In The Angry Ashtray, an inanimate object comes to life and has a surprising view about familiarity. In Blues Man Brando, actor Marlon Brando pays a surprising and surreal visit to a suburban family. In Up From the Ashes, a local historical society decides to turn back the clock, way back. In A Hard Way's Night, an aging rock band regroups to bid goodbye to the grungy ballroom where they got their start. And in The Three Christs of Ypsilanti, based entirely upon a true story, three psychotics attempt to convince a psychologist they are each the son of God. There are four more stories too delicious to summarize, by Jay Ashlooney and published proudly by Fresh Ink Group in soft, hard, and all digital formats. Practical Problems delivers what it promises.
So is this worth getting, Joe?
Very nice. Very
yeah,
nice. Very
best one.
Well, Practical Problems, like I said, like we said, is a collection of orphan plays, and they arrange in the genre. Most of them are comedy. Most of them are funny, whimsical kind of stories. There's one good drama. And then there's one that is also a one-person play, and also about my sixth degree of separation to the Beatles. That's called Nowhere Man. But anyway, the idea was to get these collected, published, and then I can move on. I like to see the body of work formalized. And that's what we attempted to do here. And I appreciate your efforts in helping me make that happen. The audio commercial you did is good. It covers some of the stories. Let's talk about Blues Man Brando, who mentions. Blues Man Brando is a very, very funny story. Now, I've always been intrigued by Marlon Brando. And when I read...
Great actor.
Great actor and a very iconoclastic, you know, gentleman.
Interesting personal life, too.
Yeah. And, of course, he was in the news this week over the development that the Academy Award, the Motion Picture of Academy Arts and Sciences, agreed to apologize to this Sasheen Littlefower, who accepted who declined the Best Actor Award in 1973. For The Godfather, because of his contempt for the way American Indians have been portrayed by Hollywood. And that's very interesting. So that brought back some memories. Marlon Brando is still with us. But anyway, I'll tell you the genesis of this story. I knew that Marlon Brando liked blues. And I also knew that he played that he played harmonica. I read it in a book that I read his autobiography too, which is pretty good. But somewhere I read that he would play harmonica while on the set by just killing time. Now, I also read that he was involved in a little invention, which was a tuning key for conga drums. And which is kind of interesting. I don't know what became of that. But it was interesting of his apparently, and I had a friend who was involved in developing a microphone for harmonicas. So I just put those two together. So inspired by the tuning key, I decided, and by his love for the harmonica, I decided to have him develop an invention to create a handheld microphone for harmonicas. And this story is of his visit to an audio engineer who he wants to hire to create a model for his invention. So he visits this family and you can imagine, it's quite an interesting story of his impact on the staff.
Well, let me interject something here. I Googled that while you were talking there. Percussionist Marlon Brando patented his invention for tuning conga drums. It's considered a lost music innovation. But yeah, he obviously did that. That's cool. I didn't know anything about that.
I'm sorry. It's considered a what?
It's considered a lost musical innovation because he did the prototype. He did the prototype, patented it, and nothing ever really happened with it in terms of like making him any money or marketing it.
Right. He probably lost interest. But anyway, that's interesting. Where did you find that? I'm curious.
I just Googled Marlon Brando tuning key for conga, and a whole bunch of articles popped up. NPR's got an article on it. OpenCulture.com.
I never thought to do that. But, of course, I wrote the play a long, long time ago. But anyway, that's interesting. So you can imagine what it must be like to have a suburban family be visited by Marlon Brando. It is very, very whimsical to the point of it's almost absurdist, and that is true of several of the other plays in the collection. Going Legit, where the story of the mobsters who want to apply for a loan at a bank, they can't help themselves but shake down the banker, even though it's not their intention. That's quite funny. The Bright Side, a story called The Bright Side, which was inspired by a skit from the Ziegfeld Follies back in the 20s, is the story of how a very minor littering incident turns into a really big headache for the so-called litterer. He could have paid his $2 fine, but instead his lawyer encouraged him to fight it. So it goes to absurd extremes. And again, it's quite funny.
A little Alice's restaurant there.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That's funny. It Should Happen to You is the story of the reason I call this collection Practical Problems is because all of the characters are dealing with problems, and sometimes they're very silly problems, but they're very personal to them. So of course they're not silly to them. In It Should Happen to You, I called upon my earliest career. My first job out of college was working for a big art publishing company, and we had a gallery as well. And I used to work directly with artists. And It Should Happen to You is a story of an art dealer who wants to sign a rural artist down in Georgia, and more of a folk artist who he thinks is brilliant and he thinks he can make a lot of money on. And this folk artist completely disarms him because he has no interest in selling his work. He doesn't want to make any money on his art. For him, it's just fun. It's just a personal thing. So it's the frustration that he feels of the dealer. You know, it's unimaginable to the dealer. An artist doesn't want to be rich and famous. So that's the absurdity there. In Up from the Ashes, that was a commission story. In Detroit, there's a theater called The Players. It's an all-men's theater club. And so it's very cliquish and clannish in a way. And they adhere to certain traditions. Goes back to the early 20s. And Up from the Ashes is a story of a meeting of the Players' board of directors and our annual meeting of the theater company, and an attempt to revive it by going back to their roots. And so it's deep into the roots. That's the absurdity there. The Angry Ashtray, another story, is also an absurdist play. And it's a one-person story with a disembodied voice as the second character, and that is the voice of the ashtray. And all it's simply about how an inanimate object can feel neglected, being taken advantage of. So the ashtray, you know, comes to life, if you will, and explains its feelings. Bigger, Faster, Stronger is a story about glamour, what we used to call glamour wrestling, professional wrestling, phony wrestling. I enjoyed it when I was a kid. And as an adult, I had a good friend who was a ring announcer. And he used to tell me stories about these wrestlers. I'm talking about WWE when it was called WWF.
Yeah.
And
back when it was good.
So, yeah, when it was really good, sure. Anyway, so Bigger, Faster, Stronger is a story of how it's basically the recruitment process, how the wrestling organization finds potential wrestling stars. They want them bigger, faster, and stronger.
Hmm.
So that's basically Indeed.com version of the hiring process. A Hard Way's Night, again, another Beatles reference, is, again, an absurdist story of four aging rockers who have not played together in decades, who decided to come together to celebrate the final performance at an old venue that they used to play at, which is closing down and going to be demolished. So they get together for that one last hurrah.
Wow.
And that was they're like an 80s hair band in my mind.
Yeah.
And And the idea of the crumbling venue is taken right from real life. In Detroit, and most cities have these old ballrooms that were used for as rock clubs, which are now probably mostly gone. But there was one at Detroit, a famous one called the Grandy Ballroom, which
yeah.
the building still exists. Yeah.
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 And so
there's actually on YouTube, there's a few people that have gone and they've given the history of the Grandy Ballroom, and they've actually gone in there and show you what it looks like now, and then they put pictures up of what it looked like back in the day.
Mm.
And it's a shame because, you said, there's a bunch of those around the Detroit area that are just rotting now, decaying.
Yeah. Mm. And it was built not as a concert hall. It was built as a ballroom for dancing.
Yeah.
And had a dance studio.
Back in the old jazz and swing band era.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, Joe, so, we need to run one more commercial here and build some excitement for next week's show. And when we come back, we want to ask you about the cover for Practical Problems. And then Joe Congel's got another question on Twitter.
All right.
Submariner, 30 years of hijinks and keeping the fleet afloat. Jerry Pate's semi-autobiographical collection of 60 stories recounts his 30 years in and around the U.S. Navy submarine fleet, ranging from lighthearted to wrenching. All are poignant inside looks at naval operations rarely seen by outsiders. Topics include the real story behind the shuttle Challenger tragedy, risking his own life underwater, discovering a Soviet spy living across the street, surviving when an engine ignites, critical missions, and the everyday lives of men and women of the fleet. Compiled by author Robert G. Williscroft and proudly published by Fresh Ink Group. Submariner is available worldwide in hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. Dive into Submariner for hijinks and breathtaking adventure with this poignant memoir by a true American hero.
Yes, we're very excited about that podcast. Looking forward to having a good talk with some Navy men.
Yeah, and we are actually before the show started, we were working on the video for this book, and we're working on some new transitions, and so they're new to both of us, so we're kind of doing a little testing here and there, and you know, but we want to add some new wrinkles to our production, so
it should be tomorrow night.
That's
tomorrow
great.
Night is probably when this will get uploaded.
Yeah.
That's great.
So,
I look forward to it.
That's interesting. So what's happening on Twitter, Beam?
Joe Congel has a question for you, Joseph. He said, Joseph, who was your favorite playwright and why did you choose that person?
Oh, I don't have favorites of anything. I really don't. I was inspired by Shakespeare early on. I liked Shakespeare. because of those plays are so universal and the language is so wonderful. But I saw on TCM a couple of nights ago during the Elizabeth Taylor day, Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which, by the way, I learned that he did not adapt for that script. That script was written by a screenwriter. But anyway, I like Albee. I like him a lot. I like Terrence McNeil. I'll mention a new playwright who's out of Detroit, who's made quite a name for herself, including having won a Pulitzer Prize, named Dominique Morisseau, who's written a number of important plays and has achieved a great deal of success, wrote something called the Detroit Trilogy, and has written for TV and for film. And right now in Detroit, she wrote and is being performed a play about the Temptations called Ain't Too Proud. And she wrote the book for that. I heard an interview with her yesterday. That's the story of the Temptations. So she's achieved a great deal of success, and I really admire her. Her name is Dominique Morisseau. Other than that, I like the absurdist plays. I do. I like comedies. I like Jeff Daniels plays because they're all comedies.
Yeah.
I saw a couple of weeks, 2 weeks ago, I saw a stage version of Mitch Albom's book. Tuesdays with Maury. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I thought that was, that's a good story.
Always,
and it works as a it works as a two-hander. It's a bit
another Detroit guy.
Another Detroit guy.
Came out of sports writing.
He's achieved tremendous success.
Yeah.
And he's very, very generous. Has a philanthropy and does some tremendous work in that area. Just tremendous. I give him a lot of credit.
So this newest book, Practical Problems, when it came to me, the cover was in draft form. It wasn't finished yet. It was being worked on. Who started that? And let's give her a shout out. You want to?
Well, that was developed by a dear old friend who I used to work with for many, many years, named Thelma Kahn, who unfortunately...
Thelma Kahn. I got to meet her once.
Yes, you did. She's quite a wonderful woman, full of good stories. And she's an old Jewish woman who went to school, high school in the late 30s, early 40s in Detroit, and lived a very, traditional life. But she was... Boy, did she love books, and she loved to read, and she had a very peaceful death. So I'm very happy for her in that regard. But I miss her a lot. So
yeah,
cover. I give Thelma a lot of credit because, as a 65-year-old woman or maybe even older, she learned how to do Adobe and PageMaker and Photoshop and word processing. And for her, it was Thelma 3.0. And she did that till the end.
Yeah, good for her.
That's a great, she used to do the program for the Jewish Ensemble Theater, the Jet Theater here in town. And that's why I met her, was through the Jet.
Yeah, I got the chance to meet her, I liked her a lot, and I respected her and everything. So I kind of felt like it was an honor to finish this cover, try to make it as nice as possible and something that she would have been proud of. So I wanted to give her a shout-out tonight. Good old Thelma. She worked
Thank
with you,
you
for a long time. She put her heart into it, and that's the kind of people we like. Joe,
I appreciate that very much, Steve.
We're really winding down on the time here. We really didn't get to a lot of your other books. You've mentioned Meet William Shakespeare, the play, which we have for sale by Fresh Ink Group Publication. You've also got The Trial of William Shakespeare. That's a separate play, right?
Yes. The Trial of William Shakespeare was also designed to be to raise money for theater companies and some Shakespeare festivals. It works very well with Shakespeare. In the Shakespeare Festival environment. And it's a provocative title, and it's the story of the authorship controversy. It's the trial of that controversy. So it presents all the arguments for and against.
Okay, and then we've got another playbook by you called The Red Poppy, Joseph Stalin at Home. And what's that an adaptation of?
That's an adaptation of a book by a Russian writer named Yuri Kotkov that was initially called The Red Monarch. And they're basically stories in the life of Joseph Stalin. And I subtitled it, so Joseph Stalin at Home. And they're not really overtly political, although everything became most political. But they're just, it's the human side of a tyrant. And I always found that to be an interesting subject.
Okay, and then we do have one more book that Fresh Ink Group has published by you, and we hope we've got more to come. But this one's Adventures in Leninland, and this one's not a playbook, right?
No. Adventures in Leninland is, I'm glad you mentioned that. I almost forgot about it. It is a collection of articles I wrote for the Detroit News way back when, in 1989 and 1990, just as the Cold War was coming in and the Berlin Wall came down and all the communist parties in the Eastern Europe fell. And it portrays the absurdities of life in the Soviet Union. All in very interesting stories.
Oh, it's a fascinating read, too.
A world that does not exist anymore. So it's called Adventures in Leninland for a reason.
Yeah.
Because that's what they were. They were adventures. When I was in graduate school, I applied for and obtained a fellowship that was offered out of the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. They had an information department. And they sent me over there for 6 months. And I was able to see and do things that was just absolutely amazing. You know, at the time when Gorbachev had come to power, and when he was losing his grip in the throes of what he had unleashed with Perestroika and Glasnost. And it was all falling apart. It was a very interesting time. I can just think of some of the stories. But what was it like to have a funeral in the Soviet Union? You know, the Soviet Union never produced any kind of animal food, never had dog food. And I tell the story of how I went on a hunt for fish flakes for a fish tank. I mean, just absurd stories like that. How to get your car repaired.
Now, Joseph, since we're running out of time here, since you're a playwright, what kind of advice do you have for some of our listeners who may have an idea for a play? What kind of advice would you give them as a playwright?
Well, I would say study the form. Most plays are pretty formulaic. And as I mentioned in the introduction to Practical Problems, and as a general rule, when you're starting out, it's good to stick with the formula. The formula basically is introduce interesting characters, give them a problem, and figure out a way to resolve the problem. You know, conflict is always at the root of the problem. But I encourage them, and I would say stick with the short form, because they're simply more marketable. If you have it in you to do a full length play, prefer it with fact based, rather than, you know, or the opposite, utterly absurd.
Okay.
So I can't give any more advice than that. It's tough. It's tough. You have to do it because you really love it.
If there are those out there who are considering writing a play, they can go pick up a copy of Practical Problems, kind of study that. So
study the form.
Well, yeah. And there's 10 plays there. There's 10 plays there to compare.
There you go.
Yes. So our guest today has been J.S. Looney, playwright, author, talent agent, basically Renaissance man. Joe, how do people find you out there? You got a website, a blog, a Twitter handle, anything that they can use to track you down?
Yeah, my website is jeshlooney.com, and I maintain a Facebook, and I'm generally around. I'm working on a new Beatles project right now, which I'm excited about, and And I'll be doing some consulting for the Motown Museum, which is something which I'm also looking forward to, helping
yeah.
them develop ideas for new exhibits as they're
Ooh.
embarking upon a big expansion, a major
yeah.
renovation.
I also heard you mention a book of foreign phrases earlier, too, that we're going to have a talk about.
Yeah.
So it's been great having you on again, Joseph, and we definitely look forward to having you back and having some more books out by you, and definitely encourage people out there to try your hand at playwriting. It's, you know, one little one-act play doesn't hurt to try it, and, you know, you can always adapt your play into a short story or vice versa. Take one of your short stories and turn it into a play just to practice, to get used to the form.
There
great advice from J. Ash Looney, a Fresh Ink Group member and author. We're proud to have him, and we look forward to having him again. Next week, we are thrilled to have retired Naval Lieutenant Commander Jerry Pate, who, you know, is a fleet submarine commander, was involved in, like, the Challenger recovery mission, guarding Guantanamo Bay, and a whole bunch of other cool stories. He's got 60 chapters of stories in there. And with him will be Robert G. Willis-Croft. This should be a lot of fun. And then after that, Beam?
After that, we have a return visit from A.K. Wengler, Andrea Wengler. She will be on this time to talk about the Georgia food truck, but she'll also talk about her website, the Florida book, and the whole series in general, and where it's going. So you'll want to tune in for that, especially if you're interested in, if you're a foodie and you're interested in good chow and food trucks as a business. You want to tune in for that. And after that...
After that, we've got a pre-recorded show with author Paul DeBlasi III. We've already recorded this show, so I can tell you it's a very interesting episode. He's quite a fascinating guy. Got a lot of cool stuff to talk about, so make sure you tune in to check out Paul DeBlasi III. And then sometime farther after that...
In November, we're already booked. We've booked Avante Centre. She is a writer based out of California, I believe it is, and... everything I've read sounds like a really interesting woman, and we look forward to having her on, too. So that's sometime in November. I think it's November 9th or something like that. I can't remember that far ahead. But it's booked. So, and we're working on getting more guests lined up between then and now, too. So stay tuned.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again for being on the show, Joe. And
thanks, Joe.
We look forward to seeing everybody in the audience again next week. Thanks for the support on Twitter. Thanks for calling in, Dr. Allen. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.